Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Good morning. Good morning, huh? All right, fine. You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host and tyrannical director, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today for another visit is aging starlet, Miss Julianne Martin.
Can't stand him!
And making his inaugural appearance on the show is my longtime friend and hyperactive sidekick. Or wait, no. And
get it right.
Oh my god. Quiet! Making his inaugural appearance on the show is my longtime friend and taskmaster of the vocal coach, Mr. Kabir Singh.
Round tones. Hey, how's it going?
This show's going to be lots of fun for a change, because today's Sight and Sound entry is Stanley Donen and Gene Kelly's Singing in the Rain. Don't let the title fool you. This movie's a little piece of celluloid sunshine. But is it worthy of the number 20 slot on the greatest of all time list? We shall deliberate. We'll then follow that up with a discussion about our favorite depictions of friendship in the movies. Then, just to ensure that we've wrung every last bit of saccharin from our systems, we're going to finish off the show with a few final notes of positivity. Are you guys ready?
Are we?
Woo! All right, then let's...
born ready!
Hey!
Round two.
Roll up!
Gotta dance!
Mike, wow!
Sorry.
So we all would have been dubbed.
I think it's safe to say.
As you can see.
For our first topic, we're going to discuss the 20th greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll. That's right, ladies and gents, it's Singing in the Rain. This picture features some of the brightest stars in the history of the silver screen. The dashing Mr. Gene Kelly, the cute as a button Miss Debbie Reynolds, and the extremely durable Mr. Donald O'Connor. Singing in the Rain is both a celebration and send-up of the vulgarity and extravagance of the Hollywood musical. The film takes place in the late 1920s, when movie studios were starting to transition from the silent age to the age of the talkie. Gene Kelly plays Don Lockwood, a beloved actor who makes his living gesticulating wildly and pretending to swashbuckle. He's got a good thing going, that is, until the advent of movie sound. The film follows as Don, his best friend Cosmo, played by Donald O'Connor, and his new off-screen love interest, Kathy Seldon, played by Debbie Reynolds, team up to formulate a plan so that Don can seamlessly transition into the modern movie era. Oh, and they also want Kathy to replace Don's current on-screen paramour, the helium-infused Lena Lamont, played by Jean Hagen. And how, you ask, do they plan to make Kathy a star and keep Don from becoming a relic? Why, they make a musical, of course! And so we get... and so we have a movie within a movie, a musical within a musical. I ask you, can it get any more delightful? I guess we're going to talk about that. So, Julianne.
I don't understand what Kabir was trying to say. I think we all have quite wonderful voices.
I think so, too.
I think I'm also realizing what a natural silent film actor I would be, given how much of a ham I am.
Nonsense, Kabir. Your voice is perfectly mellifluous.
Anyway, Julianne, how do you like Singing in the Rain?
I like it.
All right.
Singing in the Rain is a fun little romp. I mean, it's hard to come up with something to say about it. It's such a, like, big, extravagant picture. The whole time, I was just like, wow, look at all those people being choreographed to these, like, really complicated dance moves. I think there's, you know, a little something for everyone. I like watching Gene Kelly cut a rug. The plot is a little silly, and that's fine. I mean, I was pretty excited to talk about this one just because I was like, oh, I get to watch Singing in the Rain again, which is never a bad use of an hour and 43 minutes. I was like, I'm going to be in for a rollicking good time, and what do you know? I was. I had one.
All right, Kabir, how about you? What do you think?
Okay, so I like Singing in the Rain. Mm-hmm. I would say I really like it. I think it's a really, I see why it's a really important movie in Hollywood. I mean, it's hugely impressive. All the dance numbers, the good morning, the whole good morning, and how, like, number and how much they can do in just, I think it's relatively few takes that they do that whole segment in. And it's so impressive for a movie musical. All that said, it's not my favorite movie musical, and I don't really understand why it's this high on the list, number 20, especially when something like Some Like It Hot, like, what's that, like, number 40?
It's definitely beneath Singing in the Rain.
And that just seems absurd.
Well, it's crazy.
It's not really a musical, though.
That's true.
Fine,
but yes, I agree.
Just as a film, the fact that Singing in the Rain ranks higher than Some Like It Hot just seems problematic to me. And the fact that, like, it's not just this list, it's other lists too. Like, it ranks even higher on the AFI lists. And above all the other musicals, which, I mean, really, the only other musicals that make it, I think it does rank lower than The Wizard of Oz, but
I don't know if it does anymore.
Maybe not.
Not on the AFI list.
I get so confused because there's so many versions of their list.
They keep redoing it, which, you know, they should.
But, I mean, I can see why if you were to take a step back from it and just look at it from, you know, take the sort of average of, like, what everybody thinks, I can see why Singing in the Rain would rank higher. Some Like It Hot is, like, a brass sex comedy, really, and Singing in the Rain is, like, wholesome, it's family friendly, it's a huge technical achievement. I think, you know, Some Like It Hot is one of the wittiest, greatest, you know, films ever made, but probably wasn't as much of a nightmare to make.
That's really true. Well, Marilyn might have been giving him a hard time.
All right, fine, but, you know, choreography for, like, many, many people, giant crowd scenes, huge, like, colorful costumed dance numbers. Marilyn Monroe. I don't know. I'd take Marilyn if I were a filmmaker. But, I mean, I just think that the act of making these lists, it's kind of a futile exercise. It doesn't really mean anything.
Sure.
It just gives us, you know, podcast fodder.
Sure, yeah. And for that, I am grateful. And to be honest, like, I went over the list again. And I was kind of appalled at the dearth of movie musicals. And I thought, as I was sitting down to watch Singing in the Rain, that I might resent Singing in the Rain a little bit, because it does seem to be the go-to musical. Like, we sort of check that off the list. We've got Singing in the Rain on there.
Yeah.
But as I was sitting down to watch it, I still had a ball. Like, I was immediately taken with it. It was hysterical right from the get-go. It's so colorful. It's vibrant. It's funny. The dancing is incredible. I guess I like it.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But so, why do you think that Singing in the Rain is kind of the default musical for critics? How did it get this stature?
Mostly because of its scope. Just the impressiveness of the scale at which it was made. Like, I think that it doesn't hold back. I think that it's kind of a nod, you know, like, look, we like musicals too.
Mm-hmm.
Especially this one, because it looks like it was a giant endeavor to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kabir, how about you? What do you think?
I think a lot of it probably has to do with how self-referential a film it is, and how specifically referential about movie musicals it is, and the whole process of dubbing. I read on the illustrious literary source, I'm sure everyone's familiar with this illustrious literary source, Wikipedia, that in fact Debbie Reynolds was dubbed.
Yes, isn't that interesting?
Wait, what?
Isn't that crazy?
Hold on. What? Debbie Reynolds was dubbed about being dubbed?
Yes, not only her singing voice, her talking voice. So she was dubbing for Lena Lamont. Gene Hagen was doing that dubbing. So that was her actual, Gene Hagen's real voice.
What?
Yeah, it's this whole big meta thing. What?
Yeah.
But the singing voice was not someone else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Wait,
isn't that great?
She's not dubbed through the whole movie.
Not through the whole movie, no.
Only
just
during
the parts where she is supposed to be dubbing somebody
else. And when she's singing.
And when she's singing, which is not often.
Wow.
She doesn't, like, she had a solo. She was going to have a.
So she's dubbed throughout all of the Dancing Cavalier.
Yes. Yes.
But not in, like, the whole movie.
Not in the whole
movie,
no.
Not when she's like, oh, you're a movie star.
Yeah,
movie stars are not real artists.
No. No, just in the Dancing Cavalier.
I perform in community theater, man. I'm like in a playhouse at the street. You don't even know where it's at. You're just a movie star.
So, Julianne, in the past, you've said you don't like movies about movies.
I didn't say I don't like movies about movies. I said I don't like movies, television shows, any kind of media where the source material is the creative process.
Okay.
Because it's just, I feel like it's a little alienating since most people don't understand the creative process, don't understand the technical process, and don't care to. Like, this is a really amazing medium that could be lent to any number of stories. Making it about what you're actually doing just seems a little limiting to me.
Okay.
I don't know. Just kind of irks me.
So
kinda
you don't
rubs me the wrong way.
Okay. So basically, it's okay to make a movie critiquing Hollywood or a sort of send up of Hollywood as long as it's not too myopic. It doesn't get too navel gazy.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
but no. So, but are you saying that you feel like Singin' in the Rain is nonetheless understandable by everyone? Then, I mean, I think it is.
No, I mean, I'm not. I feel like my words are being used against me.
Okay.
My rants from podcasts past are coming to haunt me.
That was the Fellini episode, right?
It was. Very good, Kavir. Somebody's been listening.
It's not my favorite genre. I'm not saying there's no merit in it, but. It just reminds me of, like, when you're standing between two mirrors, you can look at the reflection of the back of your head in the mirror and then the, like, tunnel that goes back and forth. You can make any work about making work forever and ever and ever.
Right. But this I think this film succeeds in a way that others don't because it doesn't – it's sending up the work. It's making the work seem silly and really easy and just fun. It seems just like the whole thing is just a rollicking good time.
Right.
Yeah. So
I'll
that's part of, I mean, that's part of the whole, like, West Side Story was 61 and My Fair Lady was 64. And so they're a good decade later than Singin' in the Rain.
Yeah.
But both West Side Story and My Fair Lady have basis in Broadway.
Right.
And so part of me wonders, is that actually one of the reasons why Singin' in the Rain, it's an original movie musical, sort of, even though all the music is taken from old movies and old, like, Broadway reviews.
That's true. It doesn't really follow that Broadway setup where, you know, you have, like, the expository song announcing what the hero wants or anything like that.
Right, yeah. There are two different kinds of movie musicals. There's the let's put on a show review style, and then there's the book musical, which is sort of what I associate with musicals.
Yeah.
The My Fair Ladies, the Oklahomas,
West
Side Stories.
This is how our life is, followed
precisely.
By, I don't really like this, this is what I want.
Precisely. Yes, just like that. So where the music is, the songs are more incorporated into the plot and the story versus something
the,
like
the
Singin' in
the
Rain.
Disney musicals all follow that
absolutely,
model.
Absolutely, yeah. And Singin' in the Rain, this is, I feel like, a style that's sort of gone out of favor a little bit. I mean, they were very, very popular. The early musicals are mostly all this review where you recycling songs. You know, all the Fred Astaire musicals, the 42nd Streets, the Gold Diggers, all those. And this is sort of a culmination of that style. I think this is sort of the pinnacle of that style. But it seems like it's a shame that they don't really have the other book style. So back to Singin' in the Rain. It is a parody of other Hollywood musicals, but I kept feeling like it could use a little bit more bite. Like, they were sort of going after the wrong things that were terrible about Hollywood and Hollywood musicals. But I wonder what your guys' take on that is.
I think that injecting it with more cynicism would have, I don't know, undermined some of what it is. Like, I like that it's wholesome. I don't normally like things that are, like, as American as apple pie, but I wouldn't really want to sit there and fume about how, like, messed up Hollywood is, because I do that anyway. I do that all the time.
Kabir, how about you?
I don't know. I mean, like, part of me, like, I just can't, like, it's still a studio picture, and so there's no way that it's realistically going to be really critical of right. Hollywood in the way that Hollywood needs itself to be criticized yeah. at that point.
Right.
So, like, it's just kind of, yeah, I think it's sort of, yeah, almost futile to try to think about, like, you know, I mean, the same thing with the Hays Code, like, to try to think of, like, oh, well, what if it were racier? But, like, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Because there was the Hays Code.
Yeah,
so.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, for me, the, like, do I wish it was Sunset Boulevard the musical? Well, I mean, they tried that. I guess it didn't go so well.
They did.
Wait,
they
really?
Did,
yes.
Wait, what?
Yes, I believe Andrew Lloyd Webber is the composer on that. But
I'm ready for my close-up.
Perfect. You're hired. But so there's something about the studio head that kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
That he's just like so. Wait, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm
I think you were. Like, you had it on. Yeah.
Well, that he's so kind of benevolent
yeah.
in a way.
Yeah.
And that, like, I mean, really.
Such a nice guy.
I know.
Nice fella.
Yeah. And yeah. That's really annoying.
Yeah. And but that, like, he's actually genuinely concerned for Kathy's career. There's never been a studio head in the history of Hollywood that has ever given any kind of thought to, you know, struggling actresses. I mean, and they were notorious.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, they're perfectly happy to use young actresses and then throw them out, which they sort of gloss over. I guess one of my favorite characters in the movie is Lena Lamont, and she's the villain of the film. She is the only person who's portrayed in a negative light in the entire film. And given how much I love Sunset Boulevard, and I just see that trajectory of Lena Lamont. Like, she's going to end up in that mansion with Gloria Swanson.
Oh, with me alongside her.
I know. Wouldn't
I'd
be
love
great?
To go hang out with
I know.
Them. Yeah. Yeah.
She's going to be at that poker table, you know.
Well, so.
And I feel like the movie sort of, like, makes a big joke out of all these actors that kind of lost
the
work.
The only realistic character.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Actually.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I mean, okay, maybe this is just totally bitchy of me, and as an outsider in Hollywood who's lived in LA his whole life, but, like, has never worked in the industry, and you can totally shoot me if I'm offending your morals as people who work in the industry, but she kind of seems more representative of people who work in Hollywood than anyone else in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, she's a little dumb, but she's not that dumb.
Yeah.
She's smart where it counts. She, like, you know, I love the scene where she comes in with her contract, and a contract that she doesn't even really totally understand, but she knows to call her lawyers and how to, you know, she gets it done.
Mm-hmm.
She, I mean, in the end, of course, she gets outsmarted, but that's not, I don't know, I don't even know how realistic that even is. And the whole ridiculousness about how they were going to get by having her dubbed for the whole movie without her ever even knowing. I mean, she's dumb, but she's not that dumb.
Yeah, so. I mean, she's self-serving, but who isn't? And it is kind of, they pose her as the villain, but she's really just, who wouldn't, like, be threatened by the advent of a
right,
technology
totally.
That would make them completely outmoded, especially because she's got a really cushy job. She's like a star now, and she probably worked to get there, and she doesn't want to lose that because of this you know, random the jazz singer success.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I always saw her as very sympathetic.
I mean, I think just really, like, the fact that she is self-serving, like, yes, anyone would be. Mm-hmm. And all of the other characters are far too noble. No one actually behaves that way. No one is actually going to say, oh, well, you know, sing these songs just for you so that, you know, to help you with this movie as Kathy does.
Right.
Or, you know, this Donald O'Connor's character, like, being the sidekick.
The character, yeah. Cosmo, the character... yeah. He's totally selfless. I mean, he gives no thought to ensuring that Don has this great career.
Yeah. And and Lena is gorgeous, and she's a little bit unpolished, but I mean, I think it is, you know, it is a critique of Hollywood, and I think something that had already been changing by 1952, but
right.
And then still that is, like, actually, like, a struggle that a lot of silent film actresses, when you're like, Clara Bow had a really thick Brooklyn accent.
Mm-hmm.
Did not transition well.
Theda
Bara?
Yeah.
Very few
of them did.
I love Lena Lamont as the villain. I just think she's the one that I want to hang out with the most of a lot of them.
Absolutely. Exactly. What did you guys think of the beautiful girls sequence in the Broadway melody ballet or whatever? It seemed like, for me, it sort of, there were major digressions from the plot. But I'm wondering if that bothered you at all.
I love them.
Okay. Tell me why, Julianne.
Well, the beautiful girls scene, I got a kick out of it. I think it was, like, the perfect length. It just showcases splendor. Like, both of those things are so over the top and theatrical. The costumes are so elaborate and ridiculous. I love that in the beautiful girls section, it will... suspend the camera will stay on one woman who's clearly shaking, like clearly doing some yoga moves, and it's not like a freeze frame or something. I love that. That's something I just really enjoy. And how they all come together at the end, and they're all just so overdressed. It's one of those movies where you're like, wow, look at the colors. Look at the colors on screen. Look at the, like, design of this, and how all of these visual elements are, like, moving together at once in this really impressive way. The second one, the second diversion, the pitch, I guess, for the Sid Charisse portion,
mm-hmm.
I think it went on a little long. I think we could have done without the love story, like the plot diversion within a plot diversion, you know, where, like, he and Sid Charisse are, like, on the beach or something, and she's got her long flowing hair and her gown. I like it better when she's got her little... her little bangs,
yeah,
her little bob.
Louise Brooks.
Her Louise
wig,
Brooks wig. I don't mind the plot diversion when, you know, the gotta dance, and then he meets Sid Charisse. I do get really offended when Sid Charisse is tempted to stray away because a man flashes a coin at her because she's apparently comparable to a dog or something. Like, my dog gets really excited when he sees glints of light and chases after them, and I guess so does Sid Charisse because she's a woman. So that was probably the most irritating part of both of those plot diversions.
Well, this film is incredibly sexist for a number of different reasons, been discussing. But all of the characters and how Lena Lamont is, like, really just looking after herself.
Yeah.
And but she's somehow the villain by...
Right. She rejects Don Lockwood once, and from that moment on, she is the villain of the movie.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Like, that was her was her big crime, was, to, you know, not acknowledging
Don. Well,
she's, you know,
she's an uppity bitch.
Yeah, I know.
And then... yeah, and just, like, the Kathy character is so, like, at least at first she's really, I mean, of course, like, you know, you were making fun of this earlier, Julianne, but, like, it's really cute how she's like, hey, I was in community theater. Yeah, pretty much, like, you know, oh, you're just some dumb actor and all you have to do is, you know, make facial expressions. You're not acting.
Yeah.
I'm not really in anything right now, but I will be.
As soon as they get together, she loses all trace of a personality.
As soon as she reveals that she, in fact, does know who he is, and that was really just all kind of an act. She just kind of is not really, and she just and she makes all these sacrifices for him and for Lena Lamont and for
the
studio.
But she does end up getting what she wants. But it's sort of she's a very, I want to give him credit and say she's a complicated character, but I think it was just kind of not great writing, inconsistent writing. Because at first she seems very self-reliant and perfectly happy to pursue her own career. And then once it's established that she was kind of, I don't know, like lying to him or trying to, I don't know what her motivation was for being standoffish.
It was actually an elaborate plan.
Right, exactly.
It was just the charms of Jim Kelly.
But I guess to circle back to, you mentioned the writing's kind of inconsistent. Like, I think the plot's just kind of a little thin. And I think that's where these side numbers are a little bit odd, that they kind of just, like, they take away so much from an already pretty short movie that doesn't really have that much else going on, that, like, really none of the, or very, I'm going to say none of the songs actually in any way propel the plot forward in the way that, you know, why can't the English teach their children how to speak? Or I love My Fair Lady, if you couldn't tell that already. So all that said, I feel like when I saw Singing in the Rain as a kid, I really did not get those side numbers. And I feel like it makes more sense to me now, thinking about it in the context of, like, Busby Berkeley musicals and, like, that whole tradition.
Because the plot is so thin and it's almost secondary, you're here to watch this glorious show. I enjoyed those sequences for what they were. Hmm. But I feel like we've been very critical of a movie that is so very, very delightful. I think we can all agree. Let me ask you one more question on Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
It is the 20th greatest movie of all time. Yay or nay? Kabir, what do you think?
Nay. I have so many problems with the rest of this list anyway. So I don't even know if I should be weighing in. Because, like, you know, when you talk about Fellini, I think La Dolce Vita is a much better film than 8.5.
Okay.
I just don't like to be way higher than Some Like It Hot. I mean, I guess part of me gets it in terms of kind of like averaging everyone's tastes and the fact that we've talked about so much, or we keep circling back to, like, we're being really critical, but everyone else really likes this movie.
Yeah.
So maybe because of that, maybe our opinions don't really matter. Maybe.
That is nonsense, of course. We have a podcast.
But, it would not, if I had to list my top 100 films of all time, it would not be number 20 for me. It might be on there, maybe, but it would definitely not be number 20.
Okay.
Julia? As a counter to Kabir, I'm going to say yes. Okay. Absolutely deserves the number 20 spot.
No higher, no lower?
No higher, no lower. It's perfect.
Just right.
This list came down from heaven. It is preordained.
Okay. Thank you, Julianne. I'm going to go ahead and say I agree. I think 20 is appropriate. I'm going to try not to hold the fact that there are only two other musicals on the list.
Wait,
again,
what are the
Sing
other
in the
musicals?
Rain. Meet Me in St. Louis and The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
I also think that this question is going to be, like, less and less meaningful as we get further down the list. I mean, it made sense, like, for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, even up till 10. But, like, now that we're getting it, do you think that this deserves to be the number 26, the number 34,
67.
The number 67 film of all time? Like, yes.
Right, exactly. I anticipate, I guess I should clarify. What I'm asking, really, is do you think it is worthy of the standing that it has in cinema history?
Yes, okay. I do. I think that it's like the Titanic of musicals. It's not saying that it's a shipwreck. I'm saying that you look at it and you're like, wow, that must have been really hard to make. I'm glad it exists.
Okay, yeah. I guess I feel very similarly. And like I said, I'm going to try not to hold the fact that there are very few other movie musicals against Singing in the Rain, because it is an astounding achievement. It's great. It's probably among the best, if not the best example of this, you know, the musical review that Hollywood ever produced. It's really funny. It's charming. There's tap dancing. There's so much tap dancing, which I love. So,
and yeah. Make Him Laugh. Is a great song. Absolutely. I love that song.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, I mean, I guess if that's the criteria that we're using, we accept the place in that Hollywood and historians have given it. Like, I can live with that.
Okay.
I'm, like, from a personal note, no, but if we're just talking kind of big picture.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I'm getting at.
Overall importance,
yeah.
Fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Done.
I'm singing in the rain.
Just singing in the rain.
What a glorious feeling. I'm happy again.
So my first impulse as I was putting together this podcast was that I would make the second topic a general discussion of our favorite musicals. Makes sense, right? But I've since reviewed the Sight and Sound list of the greatest movies of all time, and I now realize just how few musicals made the cut. And frankly, this dearth of movie musicals is absolutely unconscionable, and the Sight and Sound critics should be ashamed of themselves. Fortunately, FlixWise is here to remedy the situation, so you can look forward to several musical offerings for the FlixWise favorites list in the near future.
Woohoo!
Yay! But in lieu of movie musicals, I thought it would be nice to talk about our favorite on-screen friendships. Now, I could stretch and claim this subject was inspired by the friendship between the Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connell characters in Singing in the Rain, but to be honest, I'm doing this for purely sentimental reasons. I've got Julianne and Kabir sitting around the table. We've all been friends for about 10 years now. Aww. Aww. Kabir's going off to grad school soon. Aww. So I just thought this topic could be our little tribute to platonic love.
Aww.
Aww. Precious. Okay, so on that note, I think we're just going to kind of take turns talking about some of our on-screen friendships, favorite friendships. So who wants to start us off?
I'll start.
Okay.
The first one that came to mind for me.
Was also from Some Like It Hot, which we were discussing earlier. Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. Actually, both of the friendships that I thought of that transcend time and space are Jack Lemmon-based, because that man can be friends with anyone. I thought of him and Tony Curtis in Some Like It Hot, and then I thought of him with Walter Matthau in The Odd Couple and in Grumpy Old Men. And his pairing with Walter Matthau was so frequent that I have to... hypothesized that they were actually real-life friends.
Stands to reason.
Who enjoyed working together so much that they made several films about being friends with each other. And I just think that's adorable.
yeah, and there's... What's that? Animal Crackers? Not Animal Crackers. What's it called? Oh, man. It'll come to me. The Billy Wilder movie? Fortune Cookie. Sorry.
Oh,
anyway. Kabir, how about you? What are some of your favorite movie friendships?
Well, okay, so I've been talking about one of them all podcast long.
Yes.
But Higgins and Pickering, I think, are just, like, classic movie friends. And there's something just I love so much, like how much songs propel forward things in that movie, particularly the song... Why Can't a Woman... I think actually the name of the song is A Hymn to Him.
That's terrific.
Yes.
By the way, we're talking about My Fair Lady.
Yes. 1964, directed by George Cukor. And Higgins is, of course, played by Rex Harrison, who played Higgins on stage. Pickering is played in the movie by Wilfred Hyde White. And... they just have this really very cute relationship. And so in A Hymn to Him, or probably more known as Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man, he goes through all these lines of Eliza's just gone away because in, you know, excess of their friendship and Pickering being so excited about Eliza having won the bet, really her doing all the work, he manages, everyone just manages to congratulate Higgins and more or less ignore Eliza. And they're shocked to find out that she's upset. And in this scene, Higgins compares his relationship with Pickering to his relationship with Eliza. And it's just sort of this long thing about, like, why can't a woman just act more like a man? And I think it's this really, like, this homage to, like, male social relationships of that time period. Mm. And there's something just, like, so cute, too, when they first meet in the scene where they're out in Covent Garden and Higgins is taking notes because he's just taking down Eliza's dialect and but then Eliza freaks out because she thinks that he's a detective who's trying to somehow charge her for doing something improper. And then Higgins and Pickering find out that they actually have both heard of each other and are fans of each other. They're both linguists and language enthusiasts, and Higgins had wanted to go to India to meet Pickering, and Pickering had come from India to meet Higgins, and they just at last we finally meet. It's just, like, so charming and sweet, and I mean, of course, horribly sexist too, but but I don't know, this one I've just got it. I love that movie so much, and yeah. I think there's so, like, it's so critical in a way that Singing in the Rain really isn't. And to go back to our previous topic, but yeah, it's just, I think there's so much richness to it. I mean, of course, it's based on Shaw, so.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I thought of another one.
Okay.
A movie we all watched together somewhat recently.
Yes.
A movie called Thelma and Louise.
What? Yeah.
A celebration of lady friendships.
Yes.
Taken to the extreme.
Yes. Thelma and Louise.
I really liked
that. I love that movie. It's terrific. My favorite movie friendship is from, it's a pair of the foxiest gold diggers who have ever graced the silver screen. It's Lorelai Lee and Dorothy Shaw, played by Marilyn Monroe and Jane Russell in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And no, I'm not talking about the friendship between a woman and her favorite piece of compressed carbonite, but between a pair of lady friends.
Two women who have a similar goal to tie them together.
Basically, the movie follows...
It's kind of the opposite of Thelma and Louise.
Well, not so much, really. I think they have a lot in common with Thelma and Louise, because I think Dorothy and Lorelai will stick with each other through thick and thin, through rich and poor, through the, you know, the good times and the bad. They have each other's back. The general dynamic is Lorelai will hatch some scheme and Dorothy's got to get her out of it. And I love how the movie sort of subverts a trope that I have in my head, that there's the ditzy blonde who's out for romance and then the pragmatic brunette. But this one, the blonde is actually the pragmatic one. Like, she understands that romance, she feels that, like, romance is kind of it's like economics. Like, for emotional support, she turns to her friends.
The only reason that I say that Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is kind of the opposite of Thelma and Louise is that Thelma and Louise die together.
Yes.
But I kind of see Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe going their separate ways as soon as one or both of them get married.
Really?
Because it seems to me like their common purpose and the thing that ties them together, once it's no longer there, they don't really have that much in common.
I don't think they do. I think they really enjoy each other's company. In fact, the final shot of the film, spoiler alert, is a freeze frame of the two of them walking down the aisle together. I think the whole movie is basically a tribute to their friendship, and men will come and go. They don't seem to have a whole lot of use for men beyond
millions.
They can do. Yes, exactly. And again, I don't think Lorelai is a sociopath who's purely out for money. I think women during the mid-20th century may not have had as many options career-wise. And this is one way she could capitalize on her looks. And she's very, very pragmatic about it. And I love that the film doesn't judge her for that. It seems to celebrate this, like that she is being very practical. She understands that she can get ahead in this way. And I also really appreciate that the film celebrates their sexuality and makes no bones about these two being adult sexual women. The film is as delightful as Singing in the Rain, in my opinion. Plus, I think it's got a pretty strong message of sisterhood. So let's circle back. Thelma and Louise. Tell me what you like about Thelma and Louise.
They're badasses.
They sure are.
They like go on this cool, fun road trip for ladies, and they end up committing a bunch of crimes together.
Yep.
And then they become outlaws together. It's my little pipe dream, my daydream.
Well, and there is something about that film that it's like, it's so much about their friendship.
Yeah.
And about, yeah, this platonic love that putting everything on the line for each other. And
I think it's also kind of particularly about female friendships, because one of the major things they bond over is that a guy attempts to rape Thelma in the parking lot, and this prompts Louise into action. And it's implied later that that is what indeed happened to Louise when she was in Texas, and it's why she'll never go back to Texas. Mm-hmm. So, like, kind of the basis of the strong bond between them is that they relate to each other's suffering, and their suffering is based on being women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, plus they're super awesome. Yeah.
I guess then I do have a question, like, can a romantic movie be about a friendship between two people? And because I don't know, when I think of, especially when I think of just like the whole, like before you mentioned like how many movies Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau made with each other, I think of the whole lot of Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy films. And so many of them, I mean, some of them are definitely more about their relationship as husband and wife, or as boyfriend and girlfriend, or, you know, whatever their romantic relationship is. But some of them, I think, really are, there's a romantic component, but I think a lot of it has to do actually with their bonding as friends and meeting each other in, I think there's something that's even if we're not putting them in this category, there's something really unique about the way that they interacted with each other, which seems to be on a different level than how other movie couples, at least of that era, tended to interact.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's sort of, it does a disservice to romantic relationships to completely exclude the friendship portion. Hopefully, if you're married to someone or romantically attached to someone, you're also friends. But there is something special about a strictly platonic relationship.
I agree.
And I think there's some, in many cases, there's an equal amount of complexity to a platonic friendship.
Yeah.
And I think more and more, we've seen more and more movies address this.
Well, I think, and it's not to say that romantic relationships exclude the possibility of friendships. Like, friendships are kind of necessary in a romantic relationship, but I think having strong platonic friendships can really enrich your life in a way that is distinct and different and not nearly as heralded or celebrated as a romantic relationship. Because, I mean, look at the three of us. Like, we've been friends for 10 years, as Pauline pointed out. We're like grizzled old people now. And we don't need to be in each other's lives. We're not in each other's day-to-day lives, and we reach out to each other and stay in each other's lives because we still continue to enrich one another in this way that is very unique and special. I think with a romantic relationship, don't get me wrong, it's a beautiful thing, but part of it is like meeting each other's needs. It's like you enter a mutually beneficial kind of relationship where, like, you're kind of depending on each other in this way that platonic relationships don't feature that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would fear for someone who had a solid romantic relationship and no friends.
Mm-hmm.
I think friends are extremely important to a well-developed personality.
I think so, too. Aww. I'm wondering, can we maybe talk about how friendship has evolved? And I feel like there's way more depictions of realistic friendships in movies today. For instance, when I saw Bridesmaids, Julianne's making a face, but I thought, finally, I'm seeing a realistic female friendship. I totally understood their dynamic. You're making more faces at me.
I sure am.
I think it totally got at the, there's this competitive aspect to female friendships.
Yes.
And there's a jealousy component. And I felt like Bridesmaids really accurately depicted that. And it also accurately depicted how you need to maintain your friendships.
Yeah.
As you get older, you need to make them a priority because there's going to be more and more distractions in your life. And it's about, the film I felt was about reconciling that and allowing your friendship to evolve. That obviously the movie stars Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph as a pair of longtime friends. And the Maya Rudolph character, Lillian, gets engaged. And it's about Kristen Wiig dealing with the fact that her friend is, her life is, she's no longer going to be as available to Kristen Wiig, Annie, as she once was. And it's about understanding that, but still recognizing that there are only so many people in the world who are going to be willing to rock out to Wilson Phillips with you, and those people are worth holding on to. So I was so moved by that movie. I love that movie. I know Julianne was not quite as taken with it. I know
largely, it was okay.
I know like maybe you were turned off by all the vomiting, which is fair.
I liked it. Okay. I maybe didn't have as passionate feelings about it as you did.
Yeah.
But no, I liked it. And I think there's something maybe about female friendships too, which I think a movie like that seems to depict in a kind of more honest way that mm-hmm. like classic Hollywood doesn't. I think because of the inherent sexism.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, because, you know, as I'm thinking back to, like, I think I'm pretty sure it's safe to say it's one of all of our favorite movies, All About Eve.
Yes.
The depiction of friendship between Bette Davis's character and her best friend, Celeste Holmes.
I was thinking of that too.
Yeah, the Celeste, like, it's really, you know, and they say several times how like great friends they are.
Yeah, it's one of the only occasions that I could think of as we were going around the table of a female having an identified best friend, but it seems so unbalanced.
Well, yeah, and just like kind of, you know, like I think how Karen, I think is her name,
yes.
She just gets more and more upset with Bette Davis and to the point where she betrays her in this really awful, horrible way and that Bette Davis never finds out about. You know, and you mentioned the competitiveness, and perhaps that's an element of female friendships, but it just seems so kind of cartoonishly, like...
Well, also, I mean, I'm sorry, but Margot and... What's her name? Oh, Karen. Margot and Karen don't seem like they have that much in common. Because Margot is just, like, a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
She's just a little thunderstorm of a woman. And Karen is just kind of boring. I mean, Celeste Holm was awesome.
Right.
But
we all love Celeste Holm.
But Karen, we
Karen
couldn't remember her.
Boring.
We couldn't remember her name. And she just sort of is there to, like, chew on her knuckles and be like, oh, I do so hope that this works out for Margot. If only she'd stop being so pig-headed, that Margot.
Yeah.
And I don't buy it. I mean, you gotta be friends with people who are your equals.
Right. Nobody is equal to Bette Davis.
Yeah.
That is
yeah.
the problem with being Bette Davis.
But I thought about that, too.
I mean, I understood what Margot was getting out of the relationship, and I understood what Karen was getting out of the relationship.
Mm.
I could see why Karen would want to be around Bette Davis, and I understood exactly. And I could understand, all right, Margot. And I can understand why Margot would want to have Karen around.
Why would she want to have Karen
around? Sort of as a kind of a ballast, someone who could, you know, talk sense into her when she needed it. Sort of a sounding
board.
And
to be frank, like, be out of the limelight
sure.
when Margot is...
Right. Well, I'm all about an All About Eve digression, but... All right, guys. Any more movie friendships that we want to bring up?
No.
No? You're good? I got one more.
Okay.
A favorite of mine is Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. Just goes to show you can be clueless and broke, but as long as your friend is by your side, you know, you are a winner in your own life, right? Right. That's a favorite of mine.
It's an adorable.
Yes. It's been a pretty upbeat show already, but just for good measure, let's close this thing out with a few final notes of positivity. Julianne, what's one thing that you've been feeling positive about lately?
Rick and Morty.
All right.
Rick and Morty is a show on Adult Swim. It's a cartoon show. And since we were just on the topic of friendships, it's about a dynamic duo. It's actually about this, like, this brilliant scientist man and his grandson, who's kind of an idiot, and they go on adventures together, and it's super weird and surreal and bizarre and hilarious, and everybody should watch it.
All right, excellent. Kabir, how about you?
It seemed appropriate on the episode about Singin' in the Rain, which is such a self-referential movie, that I've actually chosen a podcast.
Oh, perfect.
That I've been really excited about. Lexicon Valley. The Slate podcast, hosted by Mike Wollo and Bob Garfield. They explore all sorts of things in language, which is perhaps part of the reason why I'm so into My Fair Lady. Everything from ebonics to ending your sentence in a preposition or why that's not really a problem, to
vocal fry
and everything in between. And it's amazing and interesting and how the Cherokee alphabet was developed. And so it's really fantastic, and you should listen to it.
That is an excellent final note of positivity. Mine is, while I was doing research for this show, I came across an old SNL clip of Joseph Gordon-Levitt doing the make 'em dance routine, or make 'em laugh routine, sorry. And first of all, I love that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is even remotely aware of this routine. It seems like young people are not super familiar with old musicals.
I just love Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
I know, he could be my final note of positivity every week. But, but if you've never seen Singing in the Rain, I imagine the Joseph Gordon-Levitt doing this routine would have been a little confusing. So
I know what I'm going to look up when
exactly.
I go home.
And but the audience is pretty quiet throughout, but Joseph Gordon-Levitt just totally commits, and he is excellent. And I have so much more respect for him after seeing this.
Does he wear suspenders while he does
that? He wears a freaking adorable vest, and it's priceless. You gotta check it out. So that's my final note of positivity.
Wow. Make 'em laugh!
Make 'em laugh! Speaking of routines, if you're curious to see what I look like tap dancing to Singing in the Rain, I will post a link of the performance on the website, flixwise.com. If that doesn't get the masses flocking to Flixwise, then I don't know what will. Also, if you have any thoughts on Singing in the Rain, or you want to throw your favorite movie friendship into the ring, feel free to leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flixwise. You can also follow us on Twitter at flixwise. But before you do all that, make sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Next up on our Sight and Sound list, there's actually a three-way tie for the 21st spot. At the moment, I'm still trying to decide which one I'm going to do first. I think it's between La Ventura or The Godfather. It'll really depend on guest schedules, but check back on the website. I'll make sure to give you some notice to let you know which one's coming up first. Anyway, until next time, Julianne, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me!
Kabir, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Polly.
Shall we close this thing out with a song?
Oh, sure.
All right.
Yeah, I think we...
Good morning!
We'll spare you.